Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility presents the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman, exploring ideas with innovators, changemakers, business leaders, politicians, and activists. This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is underwritten in part by the Alchemist Brewery of Waterbury and Stowe, proud B Corp using the power of business to support a clean environment and economic opportunity for all. Vermont Student Assistance Corporation. VSAC helps students of all ages save, plan, and pay for college and career training with education and career planning services, need-based grants, scholarships, low-cost education loans, and Vermont's official 529 college savings plan. Green Mountain Power, delivering clean, cost-effective, and highly reliable power to customers and offering cutting-edge products and services to reduce costs and carbon. UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, the heart and science of medicine. Norwich Solar Technologies, providing complete clean energy services to Vermont schools, towns, nonprofits, and businesses. Concept 2, designers and manufacturers of Concept 2 rowing oars, indoor rower, ski erg, and bike erg, and proud to support nonprofit groups such as the Green Mountain Club. Let's Grow Kids, a statewide campaign about the need for more high-quality, affordable childcare in Vermont to better support our children, families, communities, and economy. And nearly 700 VBSR business members who believe that sustainable business practices value people, planet, and profit. Learn more at www.vbsr.org. Welcome to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. The situation in Syria seems to be going from bad to worse. In particular, the issue has been the President Trump greenlighting an invasion of Syria and an attack on the Kurds, former U.S. allies, by Turkey. Here to talk about that and to help us understand why the Kurds matter is Peter Galbraith. He's a former diplomat and a former state senator from Windham County. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, he helped uncover Saddam Hussein's gassing of the Kurds. And in the mid-1990s, he served as the first U.S. ambassador to Croatia. He recently returned from a trip to northern Syria where he was working with the Kurds. Peter Galbraith, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Good to be with you, David.
Well, we might as well start by getting your response to an item that was at the top of the news just a few minutes ago. Within the hour, President Trump announced that the conflict between Turkey and America's former Kurdish allies in Syria, quote, has nothing to do with us. What's your take on that, Peter Galbraith?
Well, if it has nothing to do with us, then the next time we confront a problem like the Islamic State, I suppose the answer is that we'll just have to do it alone and put and Trump would be quite happy to put American servicemen and women in harm's way. The fact is that the Kurds in Syria were our allies against the Islamic State. Initially, in 2014, the United States intervened to help them as they were under assault in the town of Kobani. But then, once they had taken back the Kurdish area that was of interest to them, we induced them to continue the campaign to destroy the Islamic State, to take places like Raqqa, which was the capital of the caliphate, Hasaka, Deir ez-Zor. And in the course of doing what we asked them to do, they took a total of 11,000 casualties. The United States deployed about 1,000 troops to Syria, and in the entire operation, we lost 5 people. So you just have to imagine that if we're going to do it alone the next time, we are going to lose a lot of lives. And secondly, this sends a message to every other ally that the United States is not a reliable partner, and they make their own plans. The Syrian Kurds have gone ahead and made a deal with Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian president, to allow Syrian troops now to come into northeast Syria. This is a huge victory for Assad. It's a big victory for Assad's principal ally, Iran, and it was a deal that was brokered by Russia, whom is now seen as the reliable partner when the United States isn't.
people, even GOP allies of President Trump, claim they were blindsided by Trump telling the Turkish president, or some would say dictator Erdogan, that he had a green light to go into Syria. Did that surprise you, that Trump essentially threw our former allies, the Kurds, under the bus that swiftly?
Not completely, and it didn't actually surprise them completely either. In December of this year, Trump had another conversation with Erdogan, after which he tweeted that the United States was going to have all troops out of Syria within a month. Now, that was eventually walked back. But it certainly was an indication that he wasn't a reliable partner. But what was really shocking about this is that Trump's envoy for Syria, Ambassador James Jeffrey, had just negotiated a deal between the Kurds and Turkey that the United States was a party to. And under the deal, the Kurds agreed to withdraw their troops and heavy weapons from a safe zone all along the Turkish border. And Jeffrey insisted, as part of the deal, that they should have to fill in their defensive trenches. And because the United States had been the power that brokered this, they did so. And as soon as the trenches were filled in, then Erdogan speaks to Trump, and Trump gives Erdogan the green light to invade. You might have asked, Turkey's claim is that the Syrian Kurds represent a terrorist state that's a threat to Turkey. But you have to ask, how could defensive trenches be a threat to Turkey? So it's a form of treachery that, you know, I can't think of another example like this in modern American history. I was asked repeatedly about this, about whether Trump was a reliable partner during my time in northeast Syria, when I was just there in September, and I just had to answer, I can't say, because the president of the United States is not a normal person. Who knows what he's going to do?
Let's get your response to a few of the things that Trump has said within the hour. He said that his handling of the matter has been, quote, strategically brilliant. He said that regarding the Kurds, we paid a lot of money for them to fight with us. And he also dismissed the idea that his decision has opened the way for Russia. And he said about Russia, he said, if Russia wants to get involved in Syria, that's really up to them. I don't know about you, Peter. I was astonished to hear that line. If Russia wants to get involved in somewhere, that's just up to them.
Well, there are two possibilities here. The first is that it's simply a U.S. retreat from the world, and a turning over of leadership to the Russian president, Vladimir Putin. Or, as many people have been concerned, that there's something more going on. I mean, you have to remember that the Russians played a key role in Trump's Electoral College victory. There may or may not have been, there probably wasn't collusion, but they did interfere to secure his Electoral College victory. And his behavior with Russia consistently has been hard to understand unless you think that the Russians have something on him. For example, when he met with Putin in Helsinki, they had a joint press conference, and the reporters asked, "Did you raise Russia's occupation of Crimea?" And Trump refused to answer the question. Finally, Putin came to his rescue and said, "Oh, yes, yes, he did, and he was very tough." But it was almost sounded like a former KGB agent, which Putin was, kind of trying to rescue his asset. And here, again, you have to wonder, what was it that Trump has agreed with Putin about Syria? What happened when what was contained in the notes that the interpreter had that Trump took away and that were not shared with anybody in the administration? I don't know, but there's a lot that's disturbing here about whose interest and what country he's really serving.
You're listening to the Vermont Conversation. We're speaking in this half hour with former Ambassador Peter Galbraith. He's also served as a state senator from Windham County in Vermont and has worked with the Kurds for many years in a variety of roles. You mentioned that you recently returned from northern Syria. What were you doing there?
Two things. First, with Bernard Kouchner, who was the former foreign minister of France and the founder of Doctors Without Borders. We have been involved over the years in a number of mediation efforts, partly among the different Kurdish factions between the Syrian Kurds and the Iraqi Kurds, who have very poor relations. But most recently, I've been involved in trying to help the Kurds think about how they might negotiate with Damascus. It's not my job to say whether they should or shouldn't, but I'm a professional negotiator, so the question is, how do you organize negotiations? And the second issue is that they had asked Kouchner and myself to give them some recommendations about how to handle the foreign ISIS fighters and families they have. They have about 2,000 foreign fighters, that is to say, not Iraqi, not Syrian, who are in various prisons in northeast Syria, and about 11,000 women and children who are in camps. And the problem is that governments, whether in Europe or South Asia or North Africa, don't want to take these people back. And so the question is, what do you do about them?
What has happened to those people who the Kurds have been guarding, those people in those camps? We've seen images of there being large breakouts from, you know, detention centers that were being staffed by the Kurds.
So there are the women and children are held in three detention centers. The largest of them, a place called Al-Hol, is quite some distance from the Turkish border, and that continues to be guarded by the Kurds. But another center called Ayn Issa was actually just a little beyond the area that Erdogan said he was going to use to create a safe area. But nonetheless was shelled by the Turks, and the guards took cover. And as a result of the shelling, people in the detention center escaped, including 745 foreign women and children. Now, these women are all people who chose to go to Syria to join the Islamic State, and they're not innocent bystanders. They are people who make suicide, bombs, who organize suicide attacks. Some of them, you know, might become future suicide bombers. They helped enslave the Yazidi women. And they've been in touch with sleeper ISIS cells. So this escape is very significant. With regard to the men, the 2,000 foreigners, and then there are about 8,000 Iraqis and Syrians. Those are not that close to the border, but if Turkey's invasion were to continue, the Kurdish forces protecting them they're not going to stay and hand them over to the Turks, because you know, they themselves would be captured or killed. So if the Turks get that far, there's going to be a period of time when these people also will be able to escape. And it's important to understand that right now there are about 14,000 ISIS fighters who are in sleeper cells in Syria and Iraq. Probably most of them are in Iraq, but this is right on the border. Add another 10,000 who are in the custody of the Kurds, and you're effectively doubling the size of ISIS. So this whole thing could resume, but this time there aren't going to be any American allies. The Kurds are certainly not going to once again come to the help of the United States. So we're going to have to fight it alone, and that means a lot of American servicemen and servicewomen are going to be in mortal peril as a result of Donald Trump's decision to abandon and betray an ally.
Were you, I mean, the speed with which things have occurred in Syria, I can't recall a time when there has been this kind of reversal of roles, reversal of fortunes, where we see, you know, a call made between Erdogan and Trump, followed within hours, if not a day or two, by the Kurds realigning themselves with Russia, Iran, and Syria. Then shortly thereafter, Russia sends its own troops in to occupy the military bases that we built and had been occupying just a week ago. Does the speed at which this has happened surprise you?
It's stunning. The only analogy that I can think of, and it's not an exact analogy, is April 1975, when the U.S. Congress cut off support to the South Vietnamese Army, and the South Vietnamese Army and then collapsed, and then the North Vietnamese took Saigon with that chaotic exit that those of us who lived through that time remember, Americans and South Vietnamese being lifted off of the roof of the American embassy. But that was a slower motion process in which the Congress cut off the South Vietnamese after the, you know, in what was already clearly a losing war, and in which our ally was defeated by our adversary, the North Vietnamese. In this case, the Kurds had won the war against the Islamic State, and because of the American betrayal and facing an attack from Turkey, they had no choice but to look for the party that might help. And Russia stepped in to help and to broker a deal with Assad in which the Kurds will join the Syrian army. There are 70,000 fighters in the Syrian Democratic Forces, the Kurdish forces. So they're going to substantially enhance the Syrian army, and they're going to be there to try and push the Turks out of northern Syria. The exit is really reminiscent, although we haven't seen images, of that exit from Vietnam. And there you have, the Russians coming into an American military base near Mom Beach. They find the refrigerators full of soda and foodstuffs, the wireless router still there, clothes still hanging on hooks. It's just an astonishing reversal, you're right, and within 1 week.
Game this out. What do you imagine where we're going to be in 6 months or a year in terms of Syria, the Kurds, Turkey, and ISIS?
Well, I think one question is, how will this invasion go for Turkey? Wars are always popular in the first few days, but so far Turkey has been using proxy forces, the Syrian fighters that it's trained, and along with some Turkish troops. They're up against a pretty formidable force in the Syrian Kurds. They have 70,000 women and men who defeated the Islamic State. And the Syrian Kurds are now going to have heavy weapons and air support from the Syrian Air Force and from the Russians. So it may not go that well for Turkey. And if that's the case, then the Syrian civil war is essentially over. Assad has prevailed. He has reconquered his entire country. Maybe under the circumstances, that's not the worst outcome. What I would say is even a worse outcome is that Turkey is successful and takes over all of northeast Syria, in which case it's putting in there forces that had already been defeated. That would reignite the Syrian civil war with the potential for tens or hundreds of thousands more people killed and a huge surge of refugees. And then there's the question about the future of NATO itself. Turkish diplomats talk about invoking Article 5. This is the provision of the NATO Charter that says if one country's attacked, the others come to their defense. But nobody believes that Turkey was attacked, and nobody's going to come to Turkey's defense. In fact, the European countries have imposed the first arms embargo on a NATO member ever. They've imposed an arms embargo on their ally. The U.S. Congress is moving to enact sanctions on Turkey, legislation proposed by Senator Chris Van Hollen, Democrat of Maryland, who incidentally had accompanied me in 1988 along the Iraq-Turkey border as we documented Saddam's use of chemical weapons. He was then a staffer for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, who's been Donald Trump's biggest booster in the Congress. So if the U.S. imposes sanctions, joins the Europeans, Turkey is going to be quite isolated. Secretary of Defense on national television said he didn't think Turkey was much of an ally. So the question is, will Turkey even remain in NATO? And in turn, will NATO itself survive? And, maybe this is part of Trump's agenda. He has repeatedly said he doesn't see why the U.S. should be in NATO or why there should be a NATO.
How did you first get involved with the Kurds?
In 1987, I was working for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, handling the Near East and South Asia, and I was following something that a lot of Americans and even policymakers didn't, which was the Iran-Iraq War. And it always struck me that even if this is a war between two countries we didn't like, wars have unintended consequences, and this had gone on already for 7 years. It was a World War I-like war, trench warfare. So I decided I should go to Iraq and see what was going on. And so I did. And for totally bizarre reasons, I got permission to go to Suleimania in Iraqi Kurdistan. It was just a place I'd seen on the map, but I was kind of interested. And when I set out from Baghdad heading north, we crossed from the Arab part to the Kurdish part of Iraq, and there was something very strange, namely the places, the towns and villages that were on the maps, and I had some detailed military maps, weren't there. And eventually I began to see what was happening, which is that the Iraqi army was in the process of systematically destroying every village in Kurdistan, and you could see then people being relocated to concentration camps. I wrote this up in a report about the war in the Gulf. It was a couple of paragraphs in a 50-page report. But a Kurdish neurosurgeon, actually a guy who had treated Reagan when he was shot in 1981, got in touch with me. And he introduced me to the other Kurds, and Kurdish leaders, and they'd come to Washington. I'd hear their story, and I was very, very moved by it. Then in the next year, in 1988, when first there was the attack on the city of Halabja with chemical weapons, 5,000 people died, but the Reagan administration obscured who was responsible, said, well, maybe Iran did it, maybe both sides did it. But then I was pretty sure Iraq had done it, but you couldn't prove it. Then on the 20th of August, 88, Saddam, the Iran-Iraq war ended, and then 3 days later, Saddam started to use chemical weapons against the Kurds in place that was far from the Iranian border. So it was clearly Saddam that was doing it. I went to Senator Pell, the chairman of the committee. I put this together with what I'd seen about the destruction of the villages, and I said, this is genocide. He agreed. And I went to Jesse Helms, a very right-wing Republican, and talked to him. He agreed, and I got the two of them to sponsor legislation that imposed complete sanctions on Iraq. We called it the Prevention of Genocide Act of 1988. And it, with a sponsorship by one of the more liberal members of the Senate and one of the more conservatives, it passed without anybody reading the bill. And then I went out with Chris Van Hollen. We went along the Iraqi-Turkey border to document the use of chemical weapons. And, of course, after that, the Kurds were constantly in touch. I was there in 1991 in March during the uprising against Saddam Hussein that led to the creation of the Safe Haven and many, many trips since.
What is this? These are people you have personal relationships going back years. What is it like for you to see this abandonment of the Kurds by the U.S.?
Certainly it's not the first time. It also happened in 91 when George Bush Sr. called for an uprising, and then the uprising took place and then sat on his hands as the Iraqi army marched north. I was actually there with them as they fled toward the Turkish border. He redeemed himself by creating a safe area. I was with them in 2017 when they held the referendum for independence, and then in retaliation, they were attacked by Shia militias in an operation directed by Qasem Soleimani, the head of Iran's Quds Force, in which the Trump administration allowed a Shia militia to use American Abrams tanks to attack the Kurds, who had been our most reliable allies. Incidentally, the operation was commanded by a guy named Abu Mahdi Muhandis. He himself had been convicted and sentenced to death in Kuwait in absentia for blowing up the American embassy in 1983. So this is the third time that I've been a witness to this betrayal. It's a very painful. When I was just there in September, I met with the leaders of various political parties, and there was a young woman.
Okay, Peter, we're going to have to unfortunately leave it there.
Okay.
We're out of time, but I appreciate your reflections on this.
Sure.
Peter Galbraith, I want to thank you for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation. Peter Galbraith is a former diplomat and former state senator from Windham County. We're going to take a short break.